everybody, and welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have a really good guest for us today, and he is Rick Lenz. He is an actor. We'll have to ask him about that. He is also an award-winning author. He is also an artist, and you are also a playwright. Wowza, wowza, wowza. And I want to say the name of your book that I read, which I found that I loved it, North of Hollywood. This is his memoir, An Actor's Stumbling Baby Steps Towards Kindness and Peace. And it is a really, really great book, Rick. Really. I enjoyed it a lot. Lots of great stuff in there.
Thank you.
And you get great reviews. You get great reviews.
It did very well. Thank you. It was. I was surprised and pleased, and as any actor would be, as anybody, I guess, would be.
Yeah, and it also, you know, I read so many biographies and autobiographies. Yeah, I have since I was a kid. I don't know. I was obsessed, especially with classic movies when I was just a peewee. But, you know, I didn't even know the people I was reading about at the time, but I just loved to read their life stories. And yours.
I have to ask you a question. I'm in the middle of reading one right now. I just happened to have picked it up. It's called The Tender Bar, and my wife and I read to each other at night. And it's by J.R. Moringer, who was raised in Long Island, that he spent a lot of time at a bar. He went to Yale and then ended up working for the New York Times and LA Times and so on. But it's a wonderful, wonderful memoir if you ever...
I just love memoirs because to me, you know, I like that truth is stranger than fiction. So I got to ask you, through your book, you say you and your wife reach each other, but basically you reach your wife because she falls right to sleep. Does that happen?
I remember that. Yes. That's what happens. No, she starts reading, and she actually reads more than I do. By the time I get to start to read, she's pretty close to her limit, and she's one of those people who falls asleep easily.
How dare she? Me either.
Yeah, exactly.
She has those lethal weapon of eyes, and she falls asleep early.
Easily.
What a beast. She sounds really sweet, though. Okay, Rick, so you want to tell us about your beginning and basically your journey into becoming an actor, why you want to become, and mom and dad. There's a story, I think, that really affected you so deeply in your life. But we'll get to that one, you know, because that's in your youth. So take it away.
Okay. Well, I just looked out in the backyard. It's kind of gray here in where I live in the San Fernando Valley. And I thought I'd just... since my phone is on battery, as I guess everything is almost these days, I thought I'd just take a little stroll. Like, as a friend who was my understudy in Cactus Flower in New York, and he's in a care facility now. So I call him every day and just, you know, talk to him. And so I'm used to strolling around my backyard as I talk on the phone, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Yeah, good. Well, it's very nice back here. I'm looking at the bougainvillea and the cactus.
Lovely. Lovely.
It is nice. Yeah. Well, I started acting because I washed out of my football career very early on because I was breakable. And I kept getting,
tall and lanky, right?
Yes, exactly. And it didn't work for a football career. So I decided that the best other route to getting the girls' attention, which was all I really cared about anyway, was to, you know, prance around on the stage and
prance. I love that word.
Yeah.
Trot, prance.
Trot, yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
You were from, where were you from? Michigan, right?
I was raised mostly in Jackson, Michigan. I was my dad was in the Air Force. What was it then? Then it was the Army Air Force during the Second World War, and I was a tyke, and so we lived in various places around the country. He was a doctor, and he processed people in eye, nose, and throat. He cleared them for
the ophthalmologist.
Exactly. Yeah. And but when I was from the age of six on, I lived in Jackson, Michigan, until I went away to school. You know, after I washed out of my football and then got into high school, you know, I got into every play and show I could be in. I was just an exorbitant show off, and I loved being creative. And I was a crazy kid. I remember one time, I don't know why I'm telling this, I don't even know if I told it in the book, but my grandmother was staying with me one time when my parents were on vacation or something, and I read for my grandma, I read Casey at the Bat by, I forget who wrote that. Do you remember her hand? I don't either. Anyway, it was a poet. But anyway, I read her Casey at the Bat, and she said, oh, that's nice. And I said, yeah, I wrote it.
She believed you?
No, she said, no, you didn't.
No, you didn't put that in the book.
I learned that I was going to have to, if I was going to be creative, I was going to have to not steal other people's stuff to get the credit for being creative.
That's terrible. Yeah. But you did good. So you you made
my first lesson in plagiarism.
Yes. And also, you didn't, she knew the book, or she just knew you were lying. You had to learn
she
to either be
poem.
A better
yeah.
liar. So you played everything. You did everything. You were like Mr. Prancer. You loved to prance on the
yes,
stage.
I was prancing across the stage.
And also you did your thing with your grandma.
Well, I did that. Yes.
And you couldn't take credit for other people's
work. I don't even
know
why I told that story on myself. One of the things I did in North of Hollywood is some people said, well, it's so nice that you were so, told all these embarrassing stories. You were so honest about yourself.
You were. I mean, I felt like I got to know you. I'm like, boy.
Yeah, well, I didn't think there was any point in my telling my story because I'm not, Charles Manson or one of those, somebody who's got some
Charles Manson.
Grand movie star career to tell. So I needed to at least make sure that I was,
some juicy stuff. Yeah.
The whole truth, yes, exactly. So anyway, so I after the summer after I finished high school, I auditioned. Somebody dragged me out to the Summer Stock Theater,
which is great.
There was, oh yeah, I loved that theater. It was just terrific. And I auditioned for a little tiny role, and they said, no, you can play this better part. And so I got that, and it was just one of those lucky things that I was the right type for a lot of the things that I auditioned for, and I didn't know what it was to lose an audition for quite a while.
You didn't even have to audition for quite a while. So
no.
I thought. But you describe it beautifully and how magical it was, and you said you can still remember the sound, the smell.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And it's amazing for actors, young actors, to go to Summer Stock. I could have gone to Falmouth for Summer Stock, Falmouth Theater.
Oh, yeah, really? Oh, that's nice.
But I didn't go. I chose to do a stupid play in Boston that stunk. We should have gone to Summer Stock.
You are an actor. You are an actor.
I was.
I see.
And then I became a comic, a stand-up comic.
Oh, really? No kidding. Oh, good for you. That's a gutsy thing to do.
I was. But it's like your one-man show, like you did, and you hated it, right?
But when I did my one-man show, it was after I'd had my experience with Alan Alda, where I kind of learned how to be an improviser. I was much better at improvising after that. But I wrote my one man show after that, and it was one of those word for word things, like it was an acting job.
Oh, true. Yeah, true. If somebody doesn't laugh at you, you're like, oopsie doopsie.
Well, I just rewrite it.
Yeah.
If I don't get a laugh one night, then I just make it better. I make a better joke than next night or whatever. That worked out nicely, but I don't know what I would have done if I'd done what you had to do, which was, to kind of shoot from the hip.
It's true. It's like, you either kill, it's like, oh, I killed, or you bomb, and it's
yes.
it's so dramatic and true. But
yes.
We're talking about you today, and I want to know, you have too much good stuff to talk about, and I have so much good stuff to ask you about. Okay, so you did your Summer Stock. It was a fabulous experience, and you get married pretty young there.
Yeah, I got married very young.
How old were you?
I was 21 when I got married, and I was When I was 23, I had two sons.
Oh, my Lord. I can't even imagine.
I was no more qualified to be a father and to be considered a responsible adult than a teddy bear. I was not in any way, qualified.
You both were kids. You didn't know yourself. She didn't know who she was. You were really children. I can't imagine that.
So, I can't either. And it wasn't until later I realized that a lot of the people who were older than I was were still kids. And it takes a long time.
Yes, it does. And some people never get beyond that. They never really grow. They just kind of stay stagnant, which amazes you. The birdies are singing. I love the birds. Hi, birds. I can hear them.
Oh, you can?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm just
I love
one
birds.
Step outside my bedroom
I'm
door.
Like a bird lady, cat lady, dog lady. I love them all.
Do you know what I've discovered lately? And I know this is not to the point of what we're talking about, but there are two or three mockingbirds that live around here, are around here temporarily.
I have never seen a mockingbird or heard one.
Oh, haven't you? Oh,
no.
They're gorgeous. I speak to them. I go... And I got lots of different whistle calls. One of those things.
I yak to the birds, too.
So anyway, I've got some friends here that I talk to.
I do, too.
Mockingbirds.
I whistle, too. I'm a weirdo. Snow White, but not. Anyway.
No, mockingbirds have a kind of a Navajo facing on their wings, and once in a while when we're talking, the mockingbird, I'm assuming it's a guy who's trying to court, and he must be thinking, well, that's a really an ugly looking mockingbird standing down there. Once in a while, he flies up into the air and shows me his wings, which I'm assuming is a little kind of a male thing.
He's prancing. Yes, he's prancing.
Exactly, prancing, yes.
So then, you guys, you come to New York and live on 90th Street for a little bit.
Right. I lived at the West Side Y for a while and another Y for a while, and that was crazy, and then I went to the I moved to a kind of a not so nice area at the time, and now it's probably way gentrified. But
SRO, right on 90th Street.
Oh yeah,
the axe murder place.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't happen while I was there, but I knew the night clerk and his wife, and
how sad.
And shortly after I'd stayed there, I heard that they'd gotten.
Axed.
Axed, yeah. They were axed from this world.
And you knew who the guy was. You were riding in the elevator with him.
Yes, I did. I did know who it was. And he was a little strange when I knew him. I didn't know he was that strange.
Really? Yeah. No, I'm laughing, but it's not funny. I feel terrible for them, but you lived there. And did your wife and kids ever move out with you here?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we moved out, and then we were there after I got my first job in stock at Bucks County Playhouse in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And then my boys and my wife moved out, and we lived in Forest Hills, which I have no idea why I chose to live in Forest Hills to run an acting career in Manhattan, but I did for a year. And then after about a year, I just said, "Oh, this is too hard," and gave up and went back to Jackson. And I did things like I worked for the recreation department. I was a substitute teacher. I did all kinds of jobs. And once for a while, I sold custom made clothes for men. The only problem was that I only sold one suit, and that was to my dad. So I had to give up on that career. I was not made to be a salesman. And then I was on my way home, actually, from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, where I was enrolled to finish a master's in theater. And I was driving home, and I thought, why am I doing this? I'll just end up teaching, which is not a bad thing at all. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I just turned around and went back to New York again. And because I guess I was obsessed, or I couldn't not do it.
Well, and you know, you wanted to. That's what you wanted to do, and just
it is,
you
yeah.
got a taste of it, and then you go back, and you're like, you know, I'm young. I want to do what I want to do now, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Because some people exactly have to do it. You feel it so strongly that
I know
you don't want to live with what if, what if, what if.
Yeah.
So when did you get – I'm sorry, go on, Rick.
No, I was going to say when I got back, I started to work nonstop. I just in acting roles, and I got a job as MC at the IBM Pavilion and at the World Fair, and that was a great job, paid well, and was able to live nicely for a while.
Yeah.
And then I got a Broadway show, and so things started to move along then, except, you know, the way I was mangling my personal life, things were going nicely professionally.
Was that the Cactus Flower? You were understudy, right, first?
Well, I was, then I, a year or two after after Mating Dance, which was my Broadway.
Your debut.
Then I got the job of understudying Cactus Flower, I got elevated to the role when the guy who was playing it left, and I got that basically because Lauren Bacall, I guess she liked me, or she liked how tall I was. I think she liked that. I was about 6'4" at the time. I'm now a little less than that.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
We all
I
just
don't know how that happened.
My mother, she was 5'6", and she'd still to the day she died. She was like 5'2" when she died, you know? And I'm 5'6". What are you talking about? I'm 5'6". And I let her be 5'6". What the hell? Be 5'6". Ma, I don't care.
Yeah.
So we do it. So she liked that you were tall. Who played the Walter Matthau role?
That was Barry Nelson, who was an MGM. Forgive me. He was an MGM, one of the, you know that picture of all those actors at MGM?
Yeah.
That was taken? Yeah, okay. Well, he's in the back row. Of, and
he was a zonk row.
Yeah. He played, okay roles in some.
Wasn't he like a kid
roles.
Star? Or no?
No. Actually, he was, I think he was going to school, maybe in Stanford or something, For some reason, he managed to get people from MGM up there to see him do Macbeth, I believe.
Wow!
And they put him under contract, but he was never had enough kind of a distinctive face to have a good movie career. So then he came back. He went back to Broadway, and then he really found his niche because he was as good at playing light comedy as they say as almost anybody I ever saw. He was wonderful.
And who was the Goldie Hawn part? Who played that?
That was Brenda Vaccaro originally.
Wow.
And then I also played it with Susan Terrell, who was a character actress. I also played with Marcia Mason, who was the Goodbye Girl.
Oh, my goodness.
Girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I got a pilot out, you know, out here in Los Angeles, and that sold, and then it unsold, and they said, well, okay, we'll put you in Green Acres instead, which I did a few episodes of, and it was not, you know, it's not an exciting acting challenge, that kind of, at least it didn't seem so at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of a snotty, you know.
Well, of course.
Stage actor. And, you know,
I'm going to be a star, baby. Give me my ascot, my smoking jacket. Puff, puff.
Right. Yeah.
But I got to ask you, because there's a funny story about Lauren Bacall and Lloyd Bridges on stage in Cactus Flower. Can you tell that one to everybody? That's a hysterical.
Well, it was Lloyd had come in and replaced Barry in the role. And Lauren Bacall, who was known as Betty to her friends, that was her name, Betty Bacall.
Yeah.
She didn't like the fact that Lloyd had gotten a laugh, and Barry used to not get a particular laugh before a line that Bacall had to say, and And he'd done it out of deference. The line really wanted to build so that mm-hmm. Paul got her laugh, and that was so he knew to hold back and not get his big laugh. Molloy didn't know that, and you don't know those things when you go into a role, especially when it's been done by the people who did it before you, hundreds of times almost. And so anyway, Lloyd got this stepped on her laugh a few times, and she got really angry about it. And then later on in the play, there's a scene where she's kind of beating at him, with kind of mock anger. Hers wasn't so mock there for a while.
He had to hold on to the side of the stage so he wouldn't fall out.
Well, actually, what he had to do was just to keep from falling off, pitching off into the audience, because she was forcing him down that way. And one time he grabbed her by the wrist and apparently he left some kind of,
a little bruise or something.
On her, because Lloyd was a big, strong guy. And so anyway, Betty Bacall was married to Jason Robards at the time. And Jason was this wonderful character as well as an incredible actor. And he came over, and he was still a drinker at that time. He had gone through a period where he was one of the renowned, I don't know if that's the right word, actor, drinkers. And he
actor,
came over with a couple
extraordinaire.
Of
extraordinaire, yeah.
Yeah, right. He came over with a couple of his sort of Damon Runyon-esque kind of pals. And they went to Lloyd's dressing room, and my dressing room was right next to his. And Jason was kind of a little in his cups, and he said, "I hear you've been beating on my wife or something." And Lloyd Bridges, who was called Bud, he explained exactly what had happened. And this is not a word I'm going to put on the air, but Jason said, "You're right, Bud, Betty's a..." You can fill in
the C-word. A C-word, people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that word. And
and then they drank together, right?
And they went out and had drinks together. And
how was she to work with the whole crew? Was she, because she is, I know people worked with her. And I've heard stories, not nice, and I've never told them, but I know it's true. I know they're all true.
Well, she was prickly, and she was... I think she maybe early on she got to be a star, as very young in her very early in her life, and I think that can be a little corruptive of your soul or something if you don't have a chance to grow up first.
Because of Bogey with that whole Bogey thing gave her that whole allure, and she did. She became part of Hollywood because of him, who'd been around forever, and she was just 19 when they met. Think of that one. Yeah. Yikes.
It's so funny,
though, because I've seen Stephen, and I interviewed, do you ever watch TCM?
Oh, yeah, of course. Sure.
Do you know Eddie Muller? He does the noir and a lot of the wine commercials and stuff.
I have not been watching it for a while now. I used to watch it all the time.
I miss my guy, my comfort man.
Me too.
Robert Osborne.
I adore him. Sure.
He was like my guy. Anyway, he was on, and but I was watching an interview prior to him coming out in the show, and Stephen Bogart was doing an interview with him, and he said that he met his mother, and Stephen gives him a side look and says, "How was she?" And Jessica, because I asked her, she went down to, they do this thing in Key Largo, the Bogey Festival, and Leslie Bogart was there for the first time, and I asked Jessica about that, because I said, she stays out of it all the time, and I guess she went down there and regretted it. But right. I think Jessica said something about meeting her, and she said, "How was she?" So this is just, even her kids, come on, they knew.
They knew. I mean, I don't think anybody who knew her didn't know that she had a problem. I had a friend who was at a party for, I think it was a birthday party for Jason, and had driven Ms. Bacall, which is what I called her when I was first understudying, when he had driven Ms. Bacall back from, I think it was, you know, up in New England somewhere, and he'd driven her back, and he said that she kind of let out some of her sadness, and...
She was a big drinker for a while there herself.
I think she was. Yeah. I think that was just part of the ethos at the time. I think, you know, they were all. I know for one thing that Howard Hawks helped her or hindered her in part of her life with her voice, because he used to make women go into a sound studio and scream so that they injured their vocal.
Yes, approach. And also tell them to smoke. And I read her biography. Her autobiography, mm-hmm. and she said mm-hmm. she also used to go ride her in a convertible and scream.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so they'd have those big smoky voices, and she really did.
Sure. While I was doing Cactus Flower with her, she was constantly going to the throat doctor or whoever, yeah.
So, we have to really project yourself, too. So you got the movie Cactus Flower.
Right.
What about Lauren? Did you have any? She obviously probably thought she was going to get the part. But were you around when she found out she wasn't getting the part?
No, I wasn't. But I didn't see her. I did. I ran into her it was like 2 or 3 months after the movie came out, and Matthau had the muscle in the making of that movie because he had recently done The Odd Couple, and it's what happens in Hollywood, you know, if you get some power for a while, which he had at that time, then he gets to call the shots. And
right.
He didn't want Bacall for the role. He wanted Ingrid Bergman, whom he'd had a crush on for, I guess, a long time. And so anyway, I ran into Bacall 2 or 3 months after the film had come out at Bloomingdale's in Manhattan. And I had always been a little tongue-tied with her at best.
Yes.
And so we got to that point in our conversation of greeting. And she, you know, I think she liked me, and I liked, you know, I liked her. She was like a just see her.
She's a tough broad.
And a dear, huh?
She was like a tough broad, right?
Yeah. And... but anyway, she said, I got to the point where I couldn't think of what to say next. So I said, have you seen the movie?
Oh, no.
And she said, sounding exactly like a foghorn, no.
Oh, okay. Bye. Good seeing you again.
Okay. End of conversation.
How is it? So it was your first, was that your first movie that you had done?
Yeah. I'd done some television, but that was my first film
and
job.
Goldie's as well?
Yes, it was. Well, I think she maybe done a little thing somewhere. I'm not quite sure about that. I know she had some, aside from Laugh-In, she'd played a couple of little roles, but I don't think much. And so for Goldie and me, we were like, you know, like two kids in a candy shop because we'd both gotten these nice roles. And of course, hers won her an Academy Award.
She was. I love that movie. I just saw it. It was on TCM, and saw it. It was just maybe a month ago. I love that movie.
Yeah,
you were great in it. All of you were great. I loved Goldie.
Thank you.
I loved
thank
you. I thought you were so cute as her neighbor that would just come through. And then I loved Ingrid Bergman. I thought she was adorable.
Oh, me too.
And she, you think she had a crush on you?
Well, I actually do. She was no. This is only after the fact, but a little bit after the fact. She knew she was kind of known to have
crushes on her leading men.
On leading men,
yes.
Exactly. And I don't think she had one on Walter.
Yeah,
and,
poor Walter Matthau. He just doesn't seem like he would cut it. You know.
No, not in that way. For Ingrid Bergman, and we had a lot of time rehearsing our dance sequence, and so we spent quite a bit of time together because, you know, Jessica's dad, Claude Rains, we talked about him from they had done Notorious together, And we had other things that we just, we got along really well.
And you also talked about Casablanca, and she said she had she never watched it, right? Didn't she say she didn't watch it?
I'm not sure if she, it was her that never
watched
it.
Or Claude Rains.
Never watched
it.
Yeah.
And she...
I'm not sure if Ingrid saw it or not, but I do remember that that story about them not knowing how it was going to come out. You know, who
was she going to
end up with? Yeah.
No, Victor Laszlo.
She did not know. So she had to kind of play a middle of the road sort of thing, which obviously worked like crazy because.
Look at it. It's like.
Such a movie.
Yeah, it's always, like on the top lists of movies. And she said she had no real relationship with Bogey after a day of filming. They had no real relationship or anything.
Yeah, no, apparently Bogey's wife at the time, and I forget her name, was pretty...
Battling Bogart, Mayo Metha. She did some good movies, actually. They met on Marked Women, where she played a woman who was, they were hostesses in nightclubs, where, of course, they were hookers, but it was after the code. Yeah.
Gotcha.
He dumped her for Lauren Bacall.
Yeah, I guess. But during the making of Casablanca, he was not, he was being watched over, I take it. Pretty carefully by his wife. And so, from Ingrid's point of view, she just, it seemed odd to her that he would just come to his job and just leave without, saying much of any kind of a word to her. And that she was just baffled by the success of Casablanca.
Did she like Claude? She and Claude did two movies together.
Oh.
They got along great.
Oh, did she do another one? I forgot. I knew. Oh,
well, Notorious and Casablanca. Two. Yeah, because he played the Nazi, and she had to be like Mata Hari. She married him. That was a great film.
Oh, no, he was wonderful.
He's one of my favorite actors. My classic movie actors. I adore Claude Rains. And
me too.
That movie was amazing. Oh, tell us, you met him only once, right?
I met him, I think I maybe met him one time before that, but then I spent a weekend with him up in Sandwich, New Hampshire, where he was living at that time. He put on a show.
Well, that's what older actors do,
Yeah.
They have a couple of drinks
so.
And they pontificate.
Well... It wasn't that he was doing that so much as he was just performing. He found material that he loved, and he was just reading it to us. And I think poor Jess,
she left the room. That's what she said. She would go for a walk because she heard it so many times. Yeah,
right.
And people are sitting at his feet. And you were with him. Did he like you? You think?
I don't know. I really. Really couldn't tell you whether he did or not. I don't think he disliked me. I don't think he really was. It was kind of gave the feeling to me of being kind of a distracted at that age in his life, and he probably wasn't well by the time because he died. Maybe a year after I met him.
You guys, he died before you got married.
Yes, right. Just not long before, but yes.
Yeah. Well, he was great, and Notorious was unbelievable movie. He was fabulous. They all were great, but he just he owned the joint. He really did. So Ingrid, Ingrid was like that. I liked her a lot. I thought you guys were great. How was it for the four of you to work together? Were you all copacetic? Everything was groovy.
Oh, you mean Ingrid and
Matthau and Goldie and you, the four
fine.
Of you.
It was a wonderful shoot, and we had 3 weeks of rehearsal before we began, which is a rare, treat in when you make a film. And so we rehearsed it, in order, which is not the way a film usually comes together. And we shot it pretty much in order, and that was a treat, too.
How long was that? How long did it take you to shoot it?
I think it took about 10 weeks. or so, something like that.
So you were in heaven. I mean, what a great experience for your first movie. You're in Hollywood. You're with Ingrid Bergman and Walter Matthau, and then Goldie, who's your friend. And you guys share the same birthday, right?
Yes, exactly. I was sitting around with Jessica and Goldie and her husband, and or soon-to-be husband at that time, Gus, Draconis, and somebody said, "What's your sign?" or one of those questions that we all
very
asked
popular in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah, and I said, and then, so they said, "What birthday?" I said, "The 21st. I said, "So are we." They were both.
Oh, they had the same birthday as well?
They both had the same birthday. So three of us in the room were born on the same day. Funny.
And you maintain kind of a friendship with her, right?
Oh yeah, for quite a while we were friends, and then we sort of drifted apart, and I'm still in touch with her, kind of you know, from a distance. We drop a note to each other, a birthday card or something, but not much anymore.
Yeah, well, she got pretty pretty busy too. There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. What am I thinking about? Okay, Cactus Flower, Goldie. You used to ask her for roles for like 3 years, right? If she could try to get you a part in a movie.
Well, I went through a phase of doing that because she got the Academy Award
on fire.
She was yes.
She actually was very good.
I did that account.
She was.
Pardon me?
She was good. I mean, she really was. Yeah. I loved her in Cactus Flower. I just, you know, I never was a really big Goldie Hawn fan. You know, she's whatever. You know, I just, you know, not my time. A little later, and seeing Cactus Flower, I thought she was adorable. I thought you were adorable.
She was made for the role.
She was. She was adorable.
Nobody was ever writer for that part than Goldie.
Yes.
And I, you know, I played it opposite several. Actresses and she was by far the rightest for that role.
She was incredible. She really was. And you were great, and so was Ingrid, and so was Walter. But what I want to say is, so you did that for 3 years, and then the worst thing you did, you kind of did like a stalking thing with Goldie. The tennis, the incident with Julie Christie.
I have to downplay that a little bit. She asked me to come over and play tennis with her, and I think it was her friend Julie Christie was in town, or maybe she showed up after that. They had just done Shampoo together, and we had an appointment to play tennis one day, and she didn't call me and tell me where it was. Well, I knew where it was, so I just showed up,
and here I am.
And I don't think I made Goldie very happy doing that, because she was trying to, I don't know if she was trying to woo Julie into a project or not, but that's what happened.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know. That's a very funny one. And then directly after, there was one movie, and I never heard of it.
I happened to have just seen it a couple of nights ago because it was finally released this many years later on DVD. It's called How Do I Love Thee? And speaking of shooting in context, this one was shooting out of context. Jackie Gleason and Shelley Winters and Maureen O'Hara.
Great stories about that. Oh, my God.
and the first scene I had took place at a hospital in Lourdes. We didn't really shoot in Lourdes. We shot it in Miami because Jackie hated flying, so we made everything happen in Miami, which is where Jackie lived. But my first scene with Jackie, he played my father, was it appears in the scene as if he's perhaps on his last legs, that he's dying, and he's in a hospital bed. And I throw myself on him and say, "Oh, don't," whatever I said, "don't die, Dad." And I'd never met him before. And there
you guys didn't even say hi. What? Imagine love scenes. You're there like,
hi.
You know, tonguing a lady and you never met. So
I know.
But I think that would be easier than jumping on Jackie Gleason.
Yes, it's much more so. Well, Jackie was not one of the warm people exactly. And, you know, he was perfectly nice to me, but he's just, I remember Walter Matthau had told me, when I told him I was going to do that role, he said, oh, I wanted to do that movie, but my agents wouldn't let me. Well, I wish they had let him, because he was right for the part, and Jackie was not.
And he wasn't really an actor. You know, he could do Ralph Cramden, but, you know, I don't think he was an actor.
Well, there's a few things that he did well. Requiem for a Heavyweight, some of those kind of, you know, gritty things he did nicely. I think The Hustler, he was wonderful.
He was very good in that. I read his biography. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, did you really?
Tragic. What a tragic life. And he was just sort of a sad kind of angry man. And
yes, he was.
His childhood was horrendous. And
his
childhood was horrific. And so, you know, it's just, you know, and also his drinking. What, he was sober, right? He was sober,
he was sober in the beginning. Sober for the first half of the shooting, and then he got married halfway through the shooting of that film, and then he went off the wagon. And from then on, I can see, in looking at the film, I can see the long shots, he's pretty well sober in the morning, and in the close-ups and over-the-shoulder shots in the afternoon, he's pretty well, you know, half smashed, and you can see it.
Didn't Shelley Winter say something to him as well? Like he wasn't giving her anything. She's a character. Oh my God,
she is a character. She is a character. She did say to him one time, and I don't know the white context. I can't recall exactly, but she said, "Jackie, are you even trying?"
I'm sure that went over really well with him.
Didn't go over well with Jackie. No, he's. But if it had been her television or his television show, he'd have had her fired on the spot. But
away she goes, yeah.
Yeah, but she was already established on film, and you can't do that.
Also, Maureen O'Hara was there, and she was very kind, and you liked her very much. And you said she was still hot.
I liked her very much. Yeah, she was. She was, she was 50. She's a beautiful woman.
She
women
was.
Women don't stop being beautiful because they're 50.
I agree. I totally agree with you. And she was beautiful. But you said there was another movie you said which was your favorite acting experience, and I had never heard of it. And Brian Keith was in it.
Oh, that. Oh, yeah. It's called Scandalous John.
Yeah.
It was a Disney movie. Disney's big film.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Disney's big film for 1 year. And there was a mistake made, and that was, I think I talked about it in that book, and it was that Brian was 50 years old, and he was playing an 80-year-old, and he was a good character actor. He could do, he had a wide range, and he was, I really liked him a lot. Nice man.
Love his acting, too. Like you say, he's natural. I think he gets, because he's so natural, I think he was underrated as an actor, because I thought he was really fabulous.
Yeah, me too. We became kind of friends for a while, and I saw him do Da on Broadway in New York. Anyway, doing that movie, when I saw the screening of it, and he came on at the beginning of the film as this 80-year-old man, I thought, oh, God, it looks like the school play.
And it
kind of did. And they had offered the role to Jimmy Stewart, and but they had been unwilling to pay him his price, and he said no.
Wasn't it $750,000, and he said
that's
no?
That's what it was, yeah.
He said no?
Yeah, it was, exactly.
Imagine, at that time, that's even it's a lot now, but that time, it's a lot of dough. That's a lot of dough.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of dough, but on the other hand, you know, if it's a good movie, and it's Jimmy Stewart, you know, people are going to go see it.
Of course, I agree, but he just didn't want to do it. Because I can't see Brian Keith as any, but I have never heard of that movie. That was the first time I heard of it when I read your thing. Funny story, it was. A funny story about Ingrid Bergman at the premiere, what was that, 6 months later?
Yeah, right.
She sees you, and she says, Nick!
That's right. Yeah.
That's like a real, this connection, soul connection.
Yeah.
Oh, funny. I laughed. Oh, my God. Then there's another. Yeah. You're telling us in the beginning that you're not going to talk about, you know, use a T word, breast bosoms, and you're not going to talk about Jacqueline Bisset's breast bosoms. But
okay. Well, no, that was just we just lived next door.
I know, and
Jackie Bisset, and she used to
skinny dip
nude in her swimming pool, and I could not look.
She's gorgeous. She was a beautiful woman. She still is, as far as I know. I mean, she was gorgeous. But it's so funny. You're in the bathroom peeping at her. There's your poor wife in the other room. You're sitting there peeping. Yeah. And then there was one.
I was just looking, that's all.
You know, what else were you going to do? You would have been arrested.
Any man would look.
I think so. I think so, too, because she was outstandingly beautiful. Natural beauty. Yeah. And that is.
Absolutely.
Speaking of natural beauties, this was a big part you played. I don't even think if you know this. I'm a huge 70s movies and TVs person. And I watched.
Uh-huh.
I find Jessica on YouTube. I found movies that she's done. And she said, I don't remember. And I turned it to the movie. But on the, what were you first on? The Bionic Woman, the beginning of the Bionic, or Million Dollar Man?
Actually, I think Lindsay, first from this part of the, what you're asking, it's, I did an episode of Marcus Welby, and I played, we were a married couple, and she gets, I forget what.
Multiple sclerosis, MS.
Yeah, okay, yeah, and so then her husband, me, can no longer, you know.
Perform.
Get interested in her. Yeah, perform, exactly. And which is just as unlikely as anything I can imagine.
You said leprosy, I'd still be able to do her.
Exactly.
She was so beautiful then, as well.
Oh, yeah. She's, and not only that, she was a sweet, well, I just was, loved her just, and I still think she's just an extraordinary woman. And
she has that in her face, kindness, and in her eyes as well.
She does. Yes, absolutely. So to answer your question, I did there was a spinoff with her, and
she became the Bionic Woman. Steve,
yeah.
She was Steve Austin's true love. She was
Jamie
Summers.
I got some hate mail for a while.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, because I talked to David Selby, and he was the only person other than, he was on the Waltons, he was the only man other than John Walton to kiss Olivia romantically, and he got hate mail, too. So you got hate mail because you took Jamie Summers away, because she didn't remember him anyway. You were her doctor,
right? Well, that's right. She had amnesia for a while. I was the doctor who kind of brought her back to life, and so she kind of fixated on me for, you know, I guess it was natural enough. And
of course.
And she didn't remember Steve, her true love, but everybody out there knew, out there in the world knew.
And Steve was heartbroken because he sang a song.
Yeah.
It's been swelled, Jamie.
He?
And although I know we'll meet again, I love you like I love no other. Remember Steve Austin singing that love song?
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
and she's
goodness.
Like galloping in the horse, and he's singing this thing because his heart is broken because of you.
Well, now I understand better why people. And you know, there was a kind of a Bionic Woman, I don't know, fan group thing out here.
Yeah.
And so they invited me. This was years after the fact, and I took my wife Linda with me, and they could see that we were a couple and friendly, and that, you know, that I'm in love with Linda, and so I think they began to forgive me a little bit.
Good, I'm glad.
Said I did not mean to take
Jamie Summers away from the $6 million man. This is horrifying.
Exactly. I meant no harm.
I knew you had to get hate mail for that one.
Oh, I did.
So you said for 10 years you didn't have to audition on television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty great.
Well, it was wonderful. It just happened simply because I'd come out and I'd done a skein of movies, you know, back to back, and so I was at that time, the way Hollywood worked was that if you're a movie actor and you're transitioning to television, that you don't have to audition, and so I just didn't. I would go in and meet people on the. For these jobs, And I just get the job that way. And then later on, when I finally got to the place where I had to audition, then I kind of had lost the feel for it. And auditioning's a tough thing.
Yes, you're standing in a room full of people. And you hadn't been doing it. So, you know, and younger, you're a younger guy, and you didn't have to do it. And now you're not old by any means, but just older than you were. And it, I can imagine it's much, much harder then.
Oh, it was. It was. I had, you know, I think I know I wrote in the book about having been offered an episode of Columbo, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because my boys were coming out to visit, and I just didn't want to. And it was the one with Patrick McGowan at a military academy. Excuse me. And I was supposed to go back to, I think, North Carolina, and my boys were going to be here, so I just said, no, I'll just, you know, spend this time with my boys. Well, later on, I was offered I wasn't offered the job. I was offered an audition for a later Columbo, one of the later ones, and I went in, and I really just learned the part for the audition. Well, that's just the biggest no-no there is in auditioning, is to know, you know, especially for film, is to just know it too well, because you come off stagey and stiff, and that's what I did. And then I left the room after the audition, and the casting director came running after me and said, "Rick, Peter wants you to do it again. Just loosen it up." And I said, "Okay." And I went in, and I rehearsed myself into a groove, and I just gave the same performance again, and. Oh, it broke my heart.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, that big a deal, but it was,
but
you know,
still.
I liked Peter very much, and I wanted to do his show, and so.
He was nice. You did Heck Ramsey for 2 years, I guess.
And
with that funny actor, what's his name, Richard Boone. And you said he'd come in the morning, and it, like, he didn't have a face or eyes.
Well,
he was just like this red pulp.
Yeah, he was a big drinker, and I think, you know, it was to the point where it was a you know how drinking can be a sadness to somebody.
Of course,
I don't want to say he was an alcoholic, but he certainly had a bit of a problem with it, and he didn't look good in the morning, and he was such a good actor when he was good. He was just, you know, he was extraordinary. That was, I don't think I told this story. There was a scene where his fiance in the show, Heck Ramsey, dies, and he gets drunk, and he wakes up the next morning and realizes that, you know, that his fiance is gone from this earth, and it just registers with him, and you can see it, and it's like a piece of Greek tragedy. He kind of rolls out of bed and just this horrendous groan of grief. It's an extraordinary piece of acting, and he was capable of that.
I saw him in a couple of things, a remake of I Wake Up Screaming, Vicky, and he played the killer role, the cop killer. He was a cop and a killer. And I saw him in some, I can't remember, he played like a guy who had to work in a cemetery, and every time there was a plot, like a plot people bought, and they put a pin on it, they'd die.
Oh, I never saw that. That sounds interesting.
It was interesting. It's on YouTube. Yeah. I can't remember the name of it.
Wow.
You worked with some very interesting people, the Gabor sisters, in arsenic and all. Why did they agree to do it? Because they're so vain. Did they get to play like little old spinster women, or did they get to have cleavage, or what?
Well, what they did to begin with was make them one generation younger than their.
That's what I thought. They had to.
Yeah, and they also, during the first week or so of rehearsal, the rest of the cast, Jane Merrill and John Carradine and Phil Leeds, a few of us, just sat in the rehearsal room as the director, the producer, and the two ladies, Ava and Zsa-Zsa, you know, just screamed at each other, and they ended up evening out lines, which it didn't hurt that show too much for one to have.
That's so childish.
It's not the way that,
it's so-
hey, It's childish beyond belief. And the posters and the programs had to alternate who was first billed.
So, why did they do it? Did they get a lot of money or something?
Yeah, they got a lot of money. Oh, we sold out. We could have run that show around the world for years, because they were a big draw. We never had an empty seat in Chicago.
Were they? I always got the impression that Zsa Zsa was meaner than Ava. I don't know why.
Well, I'd worked with Ava on Green Acres, and so I liked her, and she was a good actress.
She was great on Green Acres. Yeah. She was so charming and adorable, to live in. Yeah. They didn't have walls for making her coffee. It was like syrup. She was adorable. She really was. She was so cute as a little dumb Ava. Right. Oh, and then go on about Ava.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the story about the rescue squad coming?
Oh, middle-aged.
Yeah, there was a time where I think it was Zsa Zsa had I think she
fainted.
She'd gone to Chicago and she charged a bunch of stuff up at I forget what the major. Excuse me, I'm closing out the airplane above us. And she went in and charged up a huge debt and then Ava found out about it because it had been charged to her charge card. And we were rehearsing and Ava fainted. just fainted from hearing this news that she was being
I think it was like $7,000 or
something
that Zsa Zsa charged.
Her dear sister had just stolen from her, and so the
medic?
Paramedic thing, yeah, exactly. And I remember him on his walkie-talkie to the whatever they called it, and talking to a home base, and he was saying, "White middle-aged woman," and she sat up bolt upright. To the effect of nobody calls me middle aged.
how old were they at the time? You never knew because I was light about their age.
I think she was Ale was about 50, and I would imagine Zsa Zsa was like 52.
Ava died very young of pneumonia. She died very
young. Yeah, Ava. Yeah, well, Ava was she was some. She was. I don't know. She was out of the country somewhere. It was one of those things where I just don't think she got the proper
Medical treatment. Exactly. I don't think she got the right diagnosis. Did they look that much alike, Rick? Because I thought Ava had a nicer look to her. She looked kinder. Zsa Zsa was more. I don't know.
They looked alike.
Softer
look.
Yeah, but you could tell. Don't you think most people could tell the difference?
Well, probably, yeah.
I mean, they looked a lot alike in a lot of plastic surgery. Why they would do that, I don't know, in the wigs and the whole nine yards. But
yeah, I don't know either. But Zsa Zsa was a character.
She was humiliating her husband. You wrote that in the story. One of her husbands, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was mean.
Yeah. Well, seems so to me, but then, I don't know.
Then she married that horrible man, and she became Princess Zsa Zsa.
Oh gosh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
She just died recently. It wasn't that long ago, and I read about.
I think within the last year. Or so.
Yes, she was like 100 and something, and he sold pictures of her like in a coma. He was just then he just sold stuff. An estate sale, and he was selling her pill bottles, and I guess some pills were in it. Yeah.
Such
a charmer.
Sorry to hear that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid to some degree Zsa Zsa got kind of...
What she deserved.
She got some karma coming home there. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, so you worked in Same Time Next Year with an actress who I thought was absolutely beautiful in her day, Vera Miles.
Uh-huh.
And you had an affair with her.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
How is she?
She was lovely. She was a good actress. She was better than she gave herself a chance to be seen, I think, by some of the choices she made. She was attractive. She's about 10 years older than I was.
Uh-huh.
And I think that I began to be aware of that, and it wasn't too long a thing. And we were still doing the play when we broke it off.
Was that okay?
No, it's not really okay. No, you don't want to end the
relationship. I mean, it's like, yikes. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. But then we did it again next year, and I directed it in Hawaii, and we did it again. And then she called me a couple of years later and said, "Do you want to do these other places?" And I said, "I wouldn't mind doing some other play, but I don't want to do that one again because I just
had enough of it.
I'd had enough of that play at that time." And
so you did
that later on.
Later on, what? Go on.
Later on, I did a lot of two character plays. A couple of them I did with Jessica, at least two. Yeah, later on I did the four poster Tilda Felcher.
She's something else, right?
Yeah.
She seemed very intense.
Oh yeah, she's very intense, but very, very, very good.
Yes, and amazing actress.
So go ahead.
So you worked with her, and you didn't have an affair with Tilda Felcher.
Oh, I was married to Linda by then.
Yeah,
and
so no Tilda.
So no, of course not. I was just thinking about the play. That's a great two character play, the four poster. Same time next year is a good play, but it's it was of its time. I think, and I shouldn't say that because a lovely Byrne Slade said, gave me a nice quote from my book. So, and it's okay. I'll say it's the second best two-character play I've been in. But I don't even know why I brought this up.
I said Tova Felcher, or did you say Tova Felcher? Anyway,
I think maybe I did. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I love that name, Tova Felcher. Tova Felcher.
I know.
She was in The Walking Dead. I watched that show.
Oh,
I couldn't believe I ever liked it, but I started watching it when I was on the treadmill after the fourth year, and I got into it. And there was Tova Felcher. Oh. Who knew?
Huh.
Anyway, I want to talk about, Vera Miles, Alfred Hitchcock loved her, and he wanted her in Vertigo, but she got pregnant and couldn't do the part.
She was cast.
Yeah.
She was cast.
She was supposed to be the Kim Novak part.
Right. And I think probably that worked out for the best as far as the movie's concerned. I don't think Vera was less of an actor than Kim Novak, but I think Kim Novak was on the just exactly right for that role.
Oh, I think it was made for her. I saw a movie with Vera Miles the other night with Joan Crawford, and it's called Autumn Leaves. And Joan, this is in her 50s hair man-do.
Right.
She has that horrible hairdo and those caterpillar eyebrows. But she's wearing white gloves and little puffy sleeve shirts and whatever. And she wanted Marlon Brando to play her younger love interest, but she got, what's his name, Cliff Robertson. And Vera plays his slutty, cheating on him with his own father, ex-wife. And it's just a Lollapalooza tour, but I think she got called a slut and a tramp by Joan Crawford in that movie.
Oh, I imagine, yeah. Gosh.
It was a good movie. Oh, also, I want to ask you about Teresa Wright, whom I adore. She's one of my favorite actresses. And you said she mothered you, but you didn't. It was just a mothering kind of thing, right?
We worked on Hamlet, and she played mom in that for me, Gertrude.
But she was also a person you could see in her kindness and warmth.
Oh, yeah. And she was as sweet as she could be. She's a lovely human.
She really was. You could tell. And when I was married to my ex-husband, and he had a movie on. I saw there was Matt Damon in it, and all of a sudden I hear a voice. There's an LA, and I'm kind of walking around the room, and I hear a voice, and I said, "Oh my God, that's Teresa Wright."
Huh.
That's her voice. Oh, and it was like Gingerbread Man or something. She still had the same voice as she did in Shadow of a Doubt or Mrs. Miniver or any of those movies.
Yeah.
I was amazed, but it's because she probably didn't smoke. She probably didn't, you know, go out and scream in rooms or anywhere.
I'm sure she didn't.
And I don't think she was a hard drinker either. I think she was just...
I don't think so, no.
She was lovely. And then I read something that you were in the TV remake of Shadow of a Doubt playing her.
I was, yeah. Yes, I was the Hume Cronin role.
Hysterical. And, did they still, you know, the only thing I remember from that, because I did watch it because I love Shadow of a Doubt, and Joseph Cotton and she and everybody was perfection in that film.
Oh, yeah.
And Hitchcock.
That's your favorite film, by the way.
Yes, yeah. I know. And you were her. Did they do the same thing? Because all I remember is Mark Harmon doing the speech at the dinner table. You know, are they human? Are they human or are they squealing animals? He just, you know, I'm like, oh, no, Mark Harmon. He just, you know, no, you shouldn't remake this movie. That's all I thought. So I remember that. And I remember the girl they cast as Charlie. And I'm like, oh, my God, what a big blank blob blue. She was just like so nothing, no charm, no nothing. And I didn't remember anything else of the other actors. But did they do the part where Herb, how's your mother, Herb? Fair to middling. Oh, did they do that part with you?
I can't recall. I can't recall. I'm sorry.
You had to be the nerdy Herb.
Yeah, I was nerdy. I remember that. And it was fun. I had fun being that character. But we did it in Northern California, I guess, maybe Oregon. I'm not sure. I think Northern California.
Well, where they shot it, it was in the right town. At the first one. Where the heck was that?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah,
where
I know.
It was. Santa
I know
something.
What you
or,
mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was up near where I did a murder she wrote with Mendocino. It's not up quite up that far, but it's close to that. And I'm not thinking of the name of the town.
Santa Rosa was where it was
Santa
done
Rosa,
the
exactly
first time.
So, yes.
Did you guys
yes.
do Santa Rosa?
Yeah, we were in Santa Rosa.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you also, one of your horrible tales is you're driving up to this place. You're going up for a job as like someone who is a murderer or an abusive camp counselor. And you drive up, you take your beloved VW and you stop there, and the director looks at you and says, "Oops, I'm sorry, but you're not what we expected."
No.
And you said, "What
do
you expect?"
That's one of those things that happens at a point in your career is you realize that you're starting to age out a little bit in terms of what they're.
But didn't he see your headshot, or did you send something from Cactus Flower, or what?
Well, I don't know. People just, you know, they are not necessarily that thoughtful about actors' time, and I don't mean to sound like I'm
no, that was really well. I would complain because it's insulting. A and B, you're driving 40 miles up, 40 miles back, and didn't your car break down on the way back?
Yes, it did. It did on the way back. Yeah, it was.
So that was a double skunk Oreo, right? That just didn't work.
Right.
You have praised for somebody. You said helped him a lot with your improv, Mr. Alan Alda.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing but good stuff about Alan.
Oh, nothing but good stuff about him. He was, he was in effect kind of, we did a play together again in Bucks County in Pennsylvania, and it was called Sunday in New York. It was one of those kind of 60s.
Sex romps.
Sex comedies, yeah, right. And it was Alan and an actress named April Sean, who was mostly a New York stage actress, and a woman named Bebe Bash, who was a
wonderful she was
actress.
A soap opera lady. I remember her.
Yeah, and a really good actress. And her mother had been a famous actress. She'd been in Diary of Anne Frank, I believe. She was the mother in that. Anyway, so we did this play, and Alan had just spent, I don't know, several months studying improv with Paul Sills, the son of Vila Spolin, who wrote the Bible for improvisation, which is, I think, called Improvisation for the Theater. And anyway, so Alan was under that kind of influence, and he was teaching, and so he became, in effect, for me, an acting teacher. And I had, you know, a bunch of different acting teachers over the years. Well, he was the first one who ever, you know, had the kind of philosophy in running the situation that he didn't. There was no kind of judgment made on whether you were doing it right or wrong. You were just doing it, and it is the way to teach. I think, to teach the arts, and it's certainly the best way to teach acting is to, you know, to be cut free to do whatever it is you do before you begin to hone down into, you know, specific craft kind of things. And it was one of the best acting experiences in my life.
He was also a very kind man, right? Just a really
well,
you could see it when he did Hawkeye or whatever, but remember, yeah. He became like the well-known at the time sensitive man who could cry, and he got made fun of big time for being the sensitive man who loved, you know what I mean? And he just,
well, I guess so, but you know, I don't take people who criticize that.
I don't either. They're jerks.
Because one of the things he did was he worked for the Equal Rights Amendment.
Oh, he was he's just, I love
years.
Him. He's an, oh yeah. He's such a great guy. And, you know, he had his wife, and he was so proud of her. And
right.
I just liked him a lot. Now, there's a story I have right here. Baseball, you weren't working much, and you started calling when your wife was asleep a baseball trivia number.
not one of my shining moments.
It's hysterical.
this was like 25 years ago or more, I hope. I used to call this baseball trivia quiz, and I won an obscene number of baseball
cheapo t-shirts.
cheapo baseballs. And you could tell this story, because I remember
you had a big bill.
I had a big bill, a big, was it phone bill, I guess? Anyway,
yes, it was like $1,000 something. It was over a grand.
Yeah. So we sent a letter from a lawyer claiming that I was not in my right mind.
You were retarded.
I was retarded.
Which is not politically correct now, but it was then.
And
you got the idea from Linda. She told you to say.
Yeah, that was Linda's idea
claimed to be retarded.
I laughed. Those particular words.
I laughed so hard. So did you have to pay it, or did you get the money? You didn't have to.
No. They let me off the hook. I didn't have to pay it.
So, you know.
Because I was temporarily insane, so I'll let myself off the hook.
That was funny. At least you weren't calling phone sex lines. You know,
at that time,
those were very popular, too. So that's a good one. You went through a lot of doubt. You went to places by yourself. You drank. You went to therapy. You went to this dive called, what was it called, McRed's or something?
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh,
was that the name of it, McRed's?
Yep.
And it was a super-duper dive, but you were like sort of the star of McRed's because people knew who you were.
Sort of.
And you said you played pool with a guy who ended up being a serial killer, wanted for killing people across the country. So you just had that killer draw. But you were sitting there.
I don't know what it was.
the killers were drawn to you. But thank God you weren't killed. Anyway, you were
sitting there
one night, and this college professor, drunkard, said to you once and turned to you and said, "You're a loser." Is that how he worded it? Just like that?
Oh, just like that. Yeah, that's what he said. And actually, I know I say it in the book. I think it was probably a good thing for me to hear at that moment, because it wasn't a smart way to be running my life, to be going up there drinking, you know, in the evening. And it was just a... So I think there was a little bit of a watershed that I said, okay, I'm not going to
you were like,
drink anymore.
You
well,
said
I pretty much stopped it.
You said, I'm being called a loser by a loser.
Yes, right.
So is that sort of when you got your zen on, the kindness, the whole nine yards? How do you think you're doing with that and you did with that? Do you think
I work at it every day. I remember it was around 2000, now a little after the turn of the millennium. I was passing television one night, and I was watching somebody on PBS. It may have been Wayne Dyer, I think it was. And I started, I bought whatever package he was selling of spiritual books and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I started to read more and more, and I've read probably, at least 100 plus of those kinds of things lately.
Linda had a lot of those books, right?
Yes, she got them exactly. Played. And so we Linda and I read to each other that way too. Every morning we read a little bit of that kind of thing.
That's so nice. So,
yeah, it is, and it has a big effect on my life because I've begun to, and it's always a renewal process, I think, but I've begun to be
mindful.
That's the word. To realize that I'm one of the group, and that we are all living and sharing the same space.
For just some time, just like Cat Stevens said, yeah, right? We're only dancing on this earth for a short while.
And it sure is the best thing that we can do if we can find a way to be kind to each other.
Because that's a big one. People seem to think kindness seems so simple, but it's not something that people practice every day. You know, just a simple act of kindness makes somebody's day, you know?
I know.
If somebody says they're whatever, kind, I'm drawn to those kind of people because I know they kind of know the deal. And I think that's fabulous. So you had like a dark side to you, and I think we all do. But some have it more so, and the way you do it. I think in some ways, I think if you wanted really to be a huge star, you could have been. But I think you self-sabotaged yourself sometimes.
I did that. And I also, I think when I met Linda, which was, it was around 1980, January. Around that time, when I was, I guess, 40 at the time, I began to not be as driven by what I'd been driven by before. I was still offered the opportunity to go back and do things that might have advanced my career, I guess, going back east. But I didn't want to be away from Abigail, Jessica's my daughter, and I didn't want to be away from Linda, so I began not to, and I've been a writer too.
A really great writer, Rick. I got to give it to you. And I'm going to read your other book that you have
gotten. Please. I hope you'll like it.
It's a noir. It's a modern noir. Goes back and forth.
It's a back and forth. Takes place between 1956 and the late 90s.
It's called The Alexandrite. It's a time travel noir. Mesmerizing. Yeah. You got first place Somerset Award for Literary Contemporary Fiction, first place Reader's Views Award Fantasy, Bronze Medal Ippy Award, Best Western Pacific Novel, one of the best books of the year, Kirkus Reviews, and many more. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I've got a new one coming out this September called Impersonators Anonymous, which is about a partly completed film that starred John Wayne and James Dean. And
that sounds great.
To complete that film, yeah.
Congratulations. So you found your niche, and you were always writing plays as well, and people put them on. So you found that. That was just what you were supposed to do. And I think you had a hell of a life there, kid. What can I say?
Yeah, thank you.
And I like in your book, you realize your mistakes, and you apologize to Susan and Jessica, And now I know you guys are all friends. Jessica says you guys have Christmas together, and I think that's fabulous.
Yep.
And
we have for a long time.
And Abigail is doing wonderfully. And
she's doing beautifully.
Yeah.
She couldn't be better.
Jessica was just there for Mom's Day and still in Mississippi, right?
Right. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
See? And she's doing a lot of really great creative stuff. I thought that was wonderful.
Oh, she's terrific.
And she has a daughter, right?
Yep. Yep, she's got a daughter, 10 years old.
And your two sons are doing fabulous.
No, they're doing great. And everything got better. Partly it got better when I started, from my point of view, when I kind of shifted my emphasis from acting to writing. And I don't even miss the acting very much anymore because this way I get to control my day.
I know, and nobody...
creative output, yes.
If you want to have a crappy day, you own it. It's not because somebody's saying
exactly
to you,
so.
You're going to have a crappy day because of me. No, I'll have a crappy day because of me. Only me.
Right.
Or I'll have a great day because of me. So it is something, and I totally get it. That's why I started doing stand-up, and then I was writing, and now that's why I started doing podcasts and doing them.
Sure.
I'm the boss, and I do three.
Oh, I think it's cool. Oh, yeah.
And I'm the
so
boss
nice.
On all of them. So I love it. And it's just fun, and it's creative, and I love talking to people, and you have been such a pleasure, Rick. I can't tell you.
Oh, thank you, Grace.
You really have, and I'd love to have you on again. You just have so much.
Oh, I'd love to do it.
And again, peeps, his book, The Alexandrite, if you love a time travel noir, and it has gotten reviews up the wazoo. Also, his memoir is incredible. And what's the name of your memoir? I'm trying to find it.
Notes of Hollywood.
Notes of Hollywood. You're taking baby steps toward becoming a kinder, happier person. And you are a kinder, happier person, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question of it. I don't think I'm bragging.
That's not bragging. That's something to be proud of.
I know. I'm a much nicer person than I used to be. So,
that's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
And you're still with Linda. Say hello to Linda for me. And
I sure will.
I will thank Jessica for getting you because you are a wonderful interview.
Yeah.
And thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, Grace.
You are wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome, Rick. Thanks so much.
Sure.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. This is a goodie. My friend, when I told him what we were going to talk about and who you were, he said, "I'm listening. Sounds great. Sounds great, doll." He calls me doll. He couldn't wait to hear it. So I know this is a great one. So thank you so much, Rick.
And, you bet, Grace. Thank you so much.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. And I'll see you soon. Bye.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers. time goes by. Moonlight and love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have its mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome.